I stand up here, and I normally, well, I stand up here as a testament to the fact that that God restores and redeems the broken. And that's not what I'm talking about today, but I just feel like I want to say that for everybody, I just want to say that. If I do, as I'm speaking today, if I do happen to just kind of burst out into tears, please just, you know, just kind of give me the pat, okay? Just be like, that's okay. Our first son, my wife had something to do with it too. Our first son is heading off to university in a week. And so we've been, we've just been kind of mentally preparing for that. And I know that there are tons of people here who have been through that before. This is our first, so it's going to be, it'll be an exciting time. It'll be a very difficult time, and we're kind of mentally preparing for that. But as I was, I apologize for the title today. I'll start with that. When I was thinking title, and I love titles, right? Like, actually, while I took a sabbatical from teaching, one of my jobs for the outdoor magazine that I worked for was just to come up with titles. Like, that's all I did, titles for the front page, titles for the stories. And when I came up with this and I was thinking about how it would read on the sign, I was like, oh no, that's not. But I was like, I wanted to talk about food today. And I realized that some of you would just be like, well, why would I come to church? Because I can just sit at home and eat food rather than, you know, have to listen to people talk about it. But talk about food, specifically about bread. And then I had to couple that with kind of trusting God with bread or food for the journey. I came up with a few titles that I was like, no, that's not going to work. One was... that is kind of funny, right? You guys are like, wow, because that one doesn't really work either. But one of I really got stuck on rye because I love rye, right? And we are going to be talking, like, Matthew 16 talks all about bread, and I think like rye bread is the best in my mind, anyways. It makes anything sound better, right? You could be like, you could be sent to school with a peanut butter sandwich. No, actually, you can't because of the allergies, but. But you could be sent to school with like a jam sandwich, and some kid could pull out like this beautiful sandwich, you know, ham and all the fixings, and you'd just be, and he'd be looking at you like, what do you have? And you'd just be like, well, I have a jam sandwich on rye. And you're just like, wow, that sounds so good. Can we trade sandwiches? Because rye just makes everything sound better. So I went with rye, but rye, I couldn't fit it in there. I wanted pumpernickel, but pumpernickel sounds too pretentious. And so I was like, peace and pumpernickel, no, that doesn't work. People would accuse me of dad jokes if I was talking about a piece of pumpernickel. So that didn't work. And to the origins of pumpernickel bread as well. I mean, it comes out of confusion. It was Napoleon who was asking for food for his horse, for bread for his horse, and the Germans were confused because he was saying pain pour Nicole, which is Nicole was his horse. Pain for, so he's asking for bread for his horse, and so that's why they started calling it pumpernickel. Anyways, I apologize. The title today is just simply like what we're going to get to is the concept that Christ, he talks about bread quite often. He actually talks about bread quite often. And bread is kind of a central image in the New Testament. It's a very important image in the New Testament. And when I stumbled across this passage in Matthew 16, where he's talking about bread a little bit differently, I was like, oh my goodness, there's so much that I learned from this passage. There was so much that I kind of gleaned from this passage that I'd love to kind of pass this along. But essentially what we're going to get to is this concept here that even when we've experienced Christ, we often trust our understanding of a situation over the direction of our soul or the direction that our soul is calling us because we live in a fallen world where the physical, it often trumps the spiritual. Our physical often trumps the spiritual, even when we've experienced Christ. But Christ calls us to pursue food for our soul before all else. He calls us to pursue food for our soul before all else. He desires that we learn to trust him for the rye. And so let's turn to Matthew 16 and let's have a quick look at Matthew 16. We're going to start in verse 5. We're going to talk a little bit about 1 to 4 as well. But let's start in verse 5 and let's read that together. So you guys don't have to read aloud. I'll read it. Sorry, I need to be clear about that. It says, later, after they crossed the other side of the lake, they being the disciples in Christ, and they discovered that they had forgotten to bring any food with them. And then Christ says, watch out, Jesus warned them. Beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They decided he was saying this because they hadn't brought any bread. Jesus knew what they were thinking, so he said, you of little faith, why are you worried about having no food? Won't you ever understand? And that question in context is very important. Won't you ever understand? Don't you remember the 5,000 I fed with 5 loaves and the baskets of food that were left over? Don't you remember the 4,000 I fed with 7 loaves and the baskets of food left over? How could you even think I was talking about food? So again, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Then at last, they understood that he wasn't speaking about yeast of bread, but about the false teachings of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. This passage, like I said, it fascinated me, and for a whole bunch of different reasons, but before we like start to uncover this passage, we're just going to back up a little bit, and we're going to put it in context, because Christ, he's actually heading across the lake because he was a little bit miffed. It was the second time that the Pharisees and the Sadducees had teamed up. And the Pharisees and the Sadducees teaming up against Christ, I don't know how to put it in today's terms without maybe using a hockey reference, but it would be like a Canucks fan and a Boston Bruins fan sitting down and having coffee together. They didn't team up. And here they were completely teamed up against Christ. The Pharisees and the Sadducees, and I don't know if you know a lot about the Pharisees and the Sadducees. I'm not going to talk very much about them today. I learned a little bit about them at some Bible camp when I was a kid. I went to Crow's Nest Lake Bible camp. Nobody here. Everybody's like, no, no. Oh, are you? I've got one back there with a Crow's Nest Lake Bible camp. That's unbelievable. It's a little camp on the number 3 highway just off of the Alberta border. It's interesting because here it's like, oh, yeah, I went to Camp Bob. Everybody's like, woo! Other people are like, oh, yeah, Homewood. Yeah, Homewood. But yeah, there we go. Yeah. But I've got one with Kent. Anyways, at Crow's Nest Lake Bible Camp, we used to sing a song about the Pharisees and the Sadducees. But really, I didn't learn much from the song thinking back about it, because I don't know if you guys remember it, but it was just like, I don't want to be a Pharisee because they're not Pharisee. And I don't want to be a Sadducee because they're so Sadducee, but I don't know if that's scriptural or not. Because anyways, that's what we used to sing at camp. It was fun, though. It was fun. I just want to be a sheep. Bah, bah, yeah? No? Okay. So the Pharisees and Sadducees teaming up against Christ, like the Pharisees, they were so focused on what they could do. They were so focused on the law. Like, that was their focus. They needed to do everything in order to be good enough. So that was their focus. They were middle class. They were focused on the law. And the Sadducees, they were upper class. They were the upper classmen. They were rich. They didn't believe in the afterlife. Pharisees did believe in the afterlife. The Sadducees didn't believe in the afterlife. And so they come to Christ. And when they come to Christ, they say this. They say, we want a sign. We need a sign. And Christ, he gets really worked up. He gets really upset. He says to them, you understand the weather. You understand that when it's red sky in the morning, that it's going to be, you know, it's going to be cloudy and it's going to not be a nice day. You understand that at night, that it's going to be a nice day the next day. He says, but you don't get what's going on. Because it's not that he hadn't performed miracles, right? He's fed the 5,000. He's turned water into wine. He's done these things. It's not that he hasn't performed miracles. They're coming and they're saying, we need a sign. Not because he's saying, they're saying it because they're like, we want to know that you are who you say you are, because he hasn't even said who he is yet. That comes next. They're saying, those miracles that you're performing, you're not performing them like from, they're not coming from God. So we need a sign that they're coming from God. And Christ says, you guys don't get it. You don't understand. Because I will provide a sign. And it's the sign of Jonah. So they're pointing up. They're saying, I want a sign. And Christ is going, I will show you a sign. And he's pointing down. And he doesn't explain it in this passage because he's already explained it. He explained it to them in Matthew 12. When he was talking about, when he was performing miracles and they're asking him there for a sign, he explains it there and he says, the only sign that I'm going to give you is the sign of Jonah. I'm going to be gone for 3 days. I'm going to be swallowed up for 3 days. And then I'm going to return and there's going to be repentance. And your souls will be fed. He's saying, that's the sign of Jonah. That's the only sign I'm going to give you guys. And we do this, this is interesting, but we do this today because them saying, I want a sign, is them saying, I want physical evidence. And we want physical over the spiritual, and we often want that. We want to know for certain before we take a step. And the spiritual, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. And culturally we do it. I mean, culturally, after kind of generations and generations and generations of faulty philosophy, we've ended up with a culture of the I am, but not the I am. We've ended up with a culture of I am good enough. I am who I say I am. I am enough. I am the creator of my own reality. I am. And God says, the sign that I bring, it will turn you to the I am. The sign of Jonah, it will turn you to the I am. But here's the thing, is that even though we're living in an I am culture that is so desperately in need of the sign of Jonah, sometimes we get stuck, as in our faith culture, sometimes we get stuck in believing that we can accomplish, that we can do that we're in control, that we can kind of physically take control of our spiritual destiny. And the way we do this often is we do it through morality, right? I can do this. I can do it right. And God will love me because I'm doing it right. And God says, no, the sign of Jonah, it says, I've accomplished this for you so that you can be in communion with me. I've accomplished this for you. Your salvation, I've accomplished this for you. Now, in no way am I negating morality. Morality we offer up as a sign of worship, as a desire to worship God. It does not save us, though. Otherwise, we become the Pharisees who aren't Pharisee. Sorry, that was... We become that. And we often kind of live by these platitudes that kind of like, that make us feel better, rather than kind of going to the source and being united with Christ. Just the other day, there was, and I can't overshare because this is actually my son's story, but just the other day, there was something very, very disappointing that happened in my son's life, my oldest son's life. There was something very disappointing. And he came into, like teenagers do, right? For those of you that have had teenagers, like teenagers do, they come in kind of just as you're falling asleep. Anybody remember those days? They come in just as you're falling asleep. Hey, mom, hey, dad. This happened. And you're like, oh, and so you're kind of like the cobwebs, or and you're listening. And as I listened to his story, my heart broke for him. Because I was like, oh man, if that would happen to me, my heart would have just been broken. And then I said to him, we talked for a bit, and then I said, don't worry, son. I said, this didn't work out. There'll be something better. And then I tried to fall asleep. So we chatted. He went to bed. I tried to fall asleep. I couldn't fall asleep because I was so bothered by what he had talked to me about. And then I thought about the advice that I gave him. And I thought, that's just a platitude. That's just something that's just me saying, like, we desire for, you know, we want to hope that something will be better. But the truth is that, and so I talked to him the next morning as we were driving. I had to drop him off somewhere. As we were driving, I said, you know what, son? I said, sometimes life is really difficult. Sometimes it's really challenging. Sometimes we're not in control of the situations that we go through. And God doesn't necessarily promise that initially it'll always be better. The next scenario that comes along, it might not be better. It might not be replaced with something better. But what God promises is that He'll give us strength to endure. That He'll give us food, He'll give us bread for the journey so that we can endure. And in the end, after we've endured, after He's given us strength to endure, after we've turned to Him and He's given us strength to endure, that's when He draws us to Him. He's at work in us, and that's His desire. It's that we trust Him beyond our circumstances. And so the circumstance that you just went through, it sucks. It just really does. Will it be replaced by something better? We sure hope so, and we'll pray for that. If it's not, we'll pray that God will work in that scenario too. And that's providing food for the journey. So then let's move to the boat now, because that's where we're at. So let's move to the boat. So after they've crossed, the disciples are like, oh no, He's found out. We forgot the bread. We needed to bring bread, and we didn't. And Christ says, He's like, oh my goodness, you guys still don't get it. And I want you to imagine this just for a moment, right? I want you to imagine this for a moment, this discussion among the disciples. Because Peter was probably like, you know, what we know of Peter, he's probably like, it wasn't just a small matter that they had forgotten bread. I mean, their commentators say that they were on their way over to Caesarea Philippi, which means that, you know, it's a city of pagans. So they're not going to be able to just find bread that they can eat anywhere, even though Christ has reminded them earlier, discussed with them earlier, that it's not food that makes us unclean. He's talked to them about that already. But he heads over, and just imagine this discussion is like, oh no, we forgot the bread. And Peter's like getting all mad, right? Because we know that Peter has a bit of a temper. He's getting all mad. He's like pulling out his sword, right? And all the guys are like covering their ears, like, don't cut my ear off. Thomas is like, I doubt it was my fault. I'm sure it was somebody else's. Judas is probably like, oh man, price of gas, having to go back. That's gonna be like so expensive. James and John, they're involved in another debate. They're like, okay, I get to sit beside Christ on the way back. Sorry, Christian humor. So they're having this debate, right? They're having this debate about who forgot the bread, who forgot to bring it. Self-preservation, right? It's human nature just kind of cropping up. And Christ is like, hey guys, over here, you still don't get it, right? Even though you saw me feed 5,000 people with just a few loaves of bread, even though you saw me feed 4,000 even with just a few loaves of bread, you still don't get it. I'm not talking about bread right now. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about something far more important. I'm talking about the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Don't get caught up in that. What we often do the same thing, right? kind of self-preservation. It kind of just like crops up in us. It appears and we're just like, oh, we got to take care of ourselves. I got to take care of myself here. And we do this with a whole bunch of different things. I mean, we do this with really we can do it with anything, right? We can do it with our success, any success that we have. Oh man, look what I accomplished. Look what I did. That was me. We can do it with our success. We can do it with our failures, right? We kind of like hunker down. I don't want anybody to see what I've just failed at, right? And so we become very afraid of failure. We can do it with hurts, right? I'm going to hold on to that. I'm going to hold on to that. That's my hurt. We can do it with trauma. We can do it with anything, you guys. We can allow self-preservation to take over when Christ is when he's actually saying, hey, give this to me. Give this issue, hand this over, right? When will you start to see that soul food, that food that I provide for the soul is like way more essential to your journey? When will you start to see that? Is it after you've given me your heart? Is it after you've gone through the process of forgiveness and you realize, hey, yeah, forgiveness, it is an essential process. When will you give that to me? Is it once you've given me your successes and you realize that pride truly was a stumbling block in your life and that it was actually creating separation? When will you guys start to understand? When will I start to understand that it's the food, the food that Christ provides us, the food that feeds our soul, that's the food that we need to turn to rather than relying on self? We desire control. We desire to hold on to everything in our lives. And Christ is saying, no, give that to me. And it's funny because those of us that like control, it's like we get to that point, right, where we're just like, fine then, you take it, fine then. But really, that's us still trying to maintain control. Because it's not a fine then, God, you take it. He wants us to go, fine then, God, I can't actually carry this anymore. There's a huge difference between kind of giving up control so that our souls can be fed and kind of going, fine then, God, you take it. There's an enormous difference between the two. There was a hymn that I used to sing as a youngster. Not the Pharisees and the Sadducees one. That wasn't a hymn. That was a camp song. Not that they don't sing hymns at camp, but... And it's a Welsh hymn, and some of you are like, anybody here that's Welsh is like, oh yeah, I know Cymbronda. And it's got a number of titles. In English, we don't call it Cymbronda. We call it Guide Me Thou, O Great Redeemer. And I used to sing it. I used to go to an Alliance church as a young child, and we used to sing this song, and it would say, God, guide me, thou, O great Redeemer, pilgrim through this barren land. I am weak, but thou art mighty. Hold me with thy powerful hand. Bread of heaven, feed me till I want no more. Feed me till I want no more. And do we see what's happening here? Because this hymn, I mean, it was the tune for the hymn, which is a beautiful tune, wasn't written until the 1900s. The actual hymn itself was written in the 1700s. And then they married the two, and that's what we sing today, or we sing when we sing hymns. But what it's saying here is it marries the two, because this song is actually a metaphor for the Israelites' journey to the promised land. And there's this marriage of the two where it's saying bread of heaven, manna, right? It's saying that the physical unites with the spiritual, where God provides for us. regardless of circumstance. Feed me till I want no more. Feed me till I want no more. And then the last stanza, I love this stanza, because it says, when I tread the verge of the Jordan, bid my anxious fears subside. Death of death and hell's destruction, land me safe on Canaan's side. Song of praises, I will ever give to thee. This last stanza reminded me, and forgive me, and I'll work towards a conclusion with this. Because when we devour, when we sit at the table, and when we understand that when Christ is talking about bread, that he's able to feed our souls, when we start to understand that, when we go beyond the fact that bread is just this physical thing that we need and that I can hoard and that I can have, we go beyond that. We begin to realize that our journey isn't simply physical, that our journey goes beyond the physical, and it reaches towards the eternal. And when we only focus on the physical, it actually divides us. It actually takes us and it divides us, because when we only focus on the physical, it divides our souls from us. It actually takes it and it does this, when in actual fact, our souls, Christ is saying, let your souls lead you, because your souls are in communion with me. Let your souls lead you. So when it says, bid my anxious fears subside, right? When I'm standing on this side of the Jordan and on that side of the Jordan is the promised land, it says, bid my anxious fears subside. Death of death and hell's destruction. And forgive me if I've, especially for students that are here, because I've told you this before, and staff members that I've worked with, I've told you this before, but I absolutely appreciate this tale so much, because it just ties everything together here. And it's called The Partner's Tale. It was written by Geoffrey Chaucer hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And it goes like this. There's a tale, but then I'm going to put it in context. The tale says this. It says, three guys are sitting in a tavern. And as they're sitting there, this funeral procession goes by. And they're like, partly because they're a little bit inebriated, they're like, we need to find out this death. And so death becomes personified. We need to find out who this death is. All of our friends seem to be going in his direction. And so they head out on this journey. They leave the tavern and they head out on this journey. And as they get out of town, there's this little cabin, and they go and knock on the door because they think, oh, maybe that's where death resides. And so they go and they knock on the door, and this decrepit old man, he comes to the door. And they say, we're trying to find death. We need to have a word with him. All of our friends are going with him. We need to have a word with him. We need to talk with him. And the decrepit old man says, he says, I don't know death, but I believe that it's just down the road under the oak tree, he says. Just down the road under the oak tree. So they head off with their newfound directions. They head off, and they don't find death under the oak tree. It's interesting. What they find is they actually find this treasure chest. And they try to lift it, and they can't lift it. And so they decide that one of them should head back into town and get a wheelbarrow, and the two will stay with it to protect it. So the one heads back into town to get the wheelbarrow. And as he's gone, the two who are protecting the wealth, they decide that they are going to kill him when he comes back. They're going to kill their friend when he comes back, so they don't have to split the wealth three ways. So they can just split it two ways. When he comes back with the wheelbarrow, the fellow with the wheelbarrow, the two carry out their plan and they kill him. And then in the wheelbarrow, they find two bottles of wine. And they drink to their success, because now they only have to divide the wine between the two of them, or they only have to divide the wealth between the two of them. They drink to their success. Unfortunately, their buddy from town had decided that he didn't want to share the wealth with them, and so he had poisoned the wine. And so they all end up dead at the near the wealth, near the treasure. But what's interesting about the story might not be the story itself, but who's telling the story, because it's the partner who's telling the story. The partner, he's come to town, and he's telling the peasants the story. And as he's telling them the story about how the dangers of wealth, as he's kind of exuding these concepts of the dangers of wealth, he himself is gaining riches from the peasants that have none. Do we understand what's happened here? Do we see what's happened here? Is that when we carry off in our own direction, and it might not be wealth. It may be, like I said, it could be 100 other things that we try to take control of in our own lives. But what we end up doing is we create this rift because we want to be in control. We don't want to listen to our souls. We don't want to listen to God. We want to be in control. And so we head off in our own direction. And when we do that, we create a brokenness. A brokenness that we're not created for. We are created for union and communion with God our Father. That's what we're created for. So when we walk with God, when we finally get to that place where we can turn over all of our control, our desires, when we can turn that over to God, He offers us, this is when we begin to experience peace through life. This is when we go from realizing that a piece of bread is not just simply a piece of bread, that a piece of bread for the soul is peace itself. We start to understand that. Let's pray.